This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Mark Vandeloot. And the book is called Between the Floods, A History of the Arikaras. It's a really just a fantastic book that I was really excited to read. Thank you for being on my show, Mark.
All right. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. Well, you're in the Netherlands as we speak. Through the miracle of the internet, we're able to have this conversation, which I think is great. So maybe you should talk a little bit about your background as a scholar. I kind of think of this book as an anthropological book. You've told me that you're really a historian, and history and anthropology are kind of related fields, but really different in outlook. But maybe you should talk a little bit about your background and what got you as a Dutch person interested in this part of American history.
Yeah, I'll be happy to do that. I mean, I went to study after high school. I went to study at the University of Utrecht in the Netherlands, and we had to figure out a field where we wanted to work in. And I was really interested in medieval history, but I took American history as well, and I thought American studies actually. And it was really interesting. And then I bombed my medieval history test really badly because it was about numismatics and things like that. And I was like, oh, maybe that's not my field. And so I transitioned into American studies. And my focus was primarily on history because that's what I was really interested in. And then I was in my final year, almost final year, and I was like, wow, this really, I've studied everything about America, but I've never been to the place. And at that time, that was around the time when the movie Dances with Wolves came out. I don't know if you remember that one with Kevin Costner.
Yes.
And I had just, we didn't have any classes on Native American history, but that movie, that movie came out, and I was like, there's the good Indians, which are the Lakotas, and then there's the bad Indians, which are the Pawnees. And I was like, I really like those Pawnees. I kind of want to learn more about that. And so I went on an exchange program to the United States, to Oklahoma, and ended up spending a year there, made a lot of contacts, and really got captured by the whole Native American history and culture side of the field. And came back, finished my degree, my master's, and then applied for a PhD at Oklahoma State University with the intention of working with the Pawnees, and ended up working with the Ponkas and the Pawnees, and ultimately ended up getting my PhD. It was interesting because one of my professors was like, oh, the Pawnees, somebody's already working on that. That was Doug Parks at Indiana University. And so that field is kind of taken. And I ended up working a little bit on Ponca history, and which was really cool and interesting. But then one day the Pawnees called our department and said, like, we need someone to do some research on the Pawnee scouts in the U.S. military in the 1860s and 70s. And my chair of my department, bless him, he's like, well, we got this Dutch guy who can do it. And so I ended up working on that. Then that became my dissertation, which ended up being my first book. And that's how I met Douglas Park, who is a linguist and an anthropologist, and that took me from Oklahoma State University to Indiana, and Indiana University, and started working on Arikara history. And the result of that is this book, Between the Floods.
So we should talk a little bit for people who made indigenous people in America are not often recognized for the variations. There's a lot of sense of, people know who the Sioux were and the Iroquois, just the kind of bigger tribes, Navajos, Hopis, people have heard of them. Smaller tribes and people who were really important in American history aren't always clearly identified, gross term Indians or Native Americans. And
sure.
So we should really talk a little bit about who the Arikara are and where they came from, which you talk about in the book, but also kind of identify them in relation to the Pawnee. We can't go into all of the details, which you talk about in the book. It's really complicated intertribal relations, particularly coming forward during the time, hundreds of years of contact with early arriving white people, which disrupted and changed forever, you know, the kind of political and religious and psychological, you know, all the relationships between the different tribes. But you start the book talking about, you know, the Arikara creation myths and how they got there. So maybe we should talk a little bit about who the Arikara were, where they came from, and how they fit into the geography of that time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you pointed that out, that there's so many, you know, there's these nations that really draw all the attentions, the Lakotas, the Sioux, the Iroquois or Haudenosaunee, you know, the Navajos, like you mentioned. But for a long time in American history, even after, you know, European arrival, nations such as the Pawnee, such as the Arikaras, were actually quite dominant on the plains. We're talking about the Plains Indians here. And it's not until really the 19th century that when, you know, with the Plains Indian Wars, with the Sioux Wars, that the Sioux kind of like capture the headlines. And ever since, everyone is talking about them as the original kind of Plains Indian, which is really a stereotype. They were latecomers. They didn't come until, what, the 18th century, and didn't become really super powerful until the 19th century. And that only lasted really for maybe half a century. And they displaced a lot of native groups, such as the Pawnee, such as the Arikaras, the Ponkas, the Omahas, and the Hidatsas, the Mandans, you name them. And that's when they took over. And ever since, we identify Plains Indians, you know, we look at the stereotype of the Lakotas. But as I said, you know, I sometimes refer to the Pawnees, the Arikaras, the Mandans and Hidatsas as the quote-unquote original Plains Indians. They were the ones who were there before the Cheyenne, the Blackfeet, the Comanches, you know, all these big tribes that are well-known before they arrived. These were the nomadic tribes. The Pawnees, Arikaras, the original Plains Indian tribes were horticulturists. They were basically farmers, you know, growing corn and things like that. And they had a tremendous impact on history. Maybe, you know, compared to their relative size today, they're a relatively small group, maybe 4,000 nowadays, up from about 800 around 1900. So, but before that, we're talking about possibly up to 10,000. I don't think we should exaggerate either. There's one estimate about 8,800, which I think is fairly realistic. But still, that was at that time a very powerful kind of group, the Arikaras. And they were closely related to the Pawnees, which were also quite numerous at the time. And so they were a dominant force on the plains until Europeans came and introduced diseases and things of that nature. We may talk about that later. Anyways, their history is fascinating, but it's very hard to reconstruct it because, you know, we don't really have any good sources nowadays. I mean, we're making some new inroads with genetics and things like that, so you can trace certain lineages and over geography and such, and archaeology. But all of that is great stuff. But one of the things that I ended up doing is looking at oral traditions. And the oral traditions of the Arikara are very clear. And they're also closely related to the Pawnees, the Caddo, and the Wichita Indians. And it talks about a migration. And a dear friend of mine, a Pawnee scholar by the name of Roger Echohawk, he once looked at the Arikara creation story and traced it. You know, there's all kinds of they came out of the earth, which is very common among corn growing nations, right? They had these stories that they came out of the earth. The Oneidas, which you're a bit familiar with, you know, they came out of the water. Others fell out of the sky. So there's all these different creations, but it's very common for these horticulturalist nations to have creation stories that they came out of the earth. And after they came out of the earth, they went on a long journey. And this journey is fascinating. They run into all kinds of obstacles. There's a great chasm, you know, a great ravine that they pass, that they are able to cross with the help of a kingfisher. There's a big dense wood. There's a lake and all of that. And my friend Roger Echohawk he theorized that, you know, maybe this is actually the journey from across the Bering Straits, you know, back in very long time ago into America. And when they came to the chasm, for example, following all kinds of animals, like game animals. And there are things in these stories that kind of refer to that. Come to the chasm, and he says, like, well, that was the Grand Canyon. And that got me interested in oral traditions, and we'll talk more about that here in a moment. But it's clear from these stories that they came from you know, far, a long distance, and it's hard to retrace that. But, you know, the idea that they came from Asia across the Bering Straits into, you know, into the Southwest, because there are some Mexican connections too, culturally speaking, and then going up the Missouri River to where they ultimately ended up in what is now present-day South Dakota, central South Dakota, where they were at the time Europeans arrived in the Americas. And along the way, you know, a nation such as the Pawnees and the Wichitas and earlier the Caddo, you know, kind of stayed behind as the Iroquois moved up north, upriver. And that's why we see this southern to northern kind of direction of these nations. And so oral traditions have something to say, to add to what we know from the archaeological record, and hopefully the genetic record will bring some other insights there as well.
Yeah, no, I think that was one of the things that really attracted me to your book, is that you give not just credence, but actual value, deep value to the tribe's own telling of their own stories, and not to dismiss it as fanciful, kind of mythological, reductionist mythological thinking, that we tend to kind of categorize myth as not literal or not real. And I know from, you know, that in language studies, in linguistic glottochronology, which is a, you know, subset of linguistics, you can trace language change over periods of time. It's not an exact science, but there are lots of markers that help you understand. And you can say, well, the Cherokee language separated from the Iroquois approximately 2,000 years ago, you know, kind of using other elements to confirm that, you can build a pretty strong case for tracking change through language. And I think the same thing is true with what people typically have called myth or oral traditions, that they are storytelling that is, and the deeper you go into the kind of cultural artifacts of a society, the less the rate of change would be. So the name of God is always this, you know, one of the things that's fairly common when you look at languages that were related to each other. So you would, you know, when you see the comparison between Arikara, Pawnee, Caddo, Wichita, you know, they're going to have similarities.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But you can also, I like the way you give them power in, you know, in their historicity, that you can say that what is true does not have to always conform to our literal ideas of what is true.
Absolutely. And this was a discovery that I kind of made, you know, kind of late in my career. I'd already finished my dissertation. And when I started studying at Oklahoma State University with George Moses, et cetera, you know, the new Western history and ethnohistory was, you know, that was our field. And of course I felt like, well, you know, I'm an ethnohistorian, so I have to look at these oral traditions, but I couldn't make any sense out of them because I was trained really as a classical historian, right? So, you know, we have textual analysis and criticism, and we try to trace these texts back to their origins. But these origin stories of these oral traditions were just so fuzzy. There were all kinds of funny things happening, speaking animals, witches, cannibals, you know, all these. And I couldn't make any heads or tails of it. And so what I did at the time, which is what a lot of my friends also did, we took these stories, and of course we took them serious as artifacts, but we didn't take them necessarily serious as historical documents, as things that had something really to say about history. We used them, I used them, let's put it that way. I used them kind of like as a sauce, you know, to sprinkle over my kind of traditional work, and then just like, oh, here's what the oral traditions say, but here's what I've found, And it wasn't until many years later, after I had gotten my degree and I finished my postdoc at Indiana University, and I ended up teaching at a small university in Kansas, Benedictine College, that one day I would always assign in my Native American history class or Native American spirituality class, I would always assign the Aricra creation story because it's a fascinating story. And there's a fascinating account by an Aricra who actually a priest in the early 1900s who explains, you know, the deeper meaning of the creation story. And so it's a fascinating esoteric text. But one day as I was teaching it, and there is a fragment in there's an element in the story in which, you know, the people, after they came out of the earth, they went on their migration, they offended. They had Mother Corn had taught them the ceremonies, the prayers, and they had forgotten to offer smoke to Whirlwind. And Whirlwind gets really mad and starts attacking the people, scattering them, killing them in large numbers. And as I was reading that, there's in one of the versions of the creation story, one of the storytellers says, like, well, this storm, this whirlwind was a disease. And as we're teaching it in class, it suddenly, you know, the light went on in my head, and I was like, wait a minute, what was a disease that was so terrible, that was so devastating, that it really, you know, not just killed people, but scattered them? And that was smallpox. And suddenly I was like, wait a minute, I should investigate this, look at other oral traditions. And from that moment on, I started looking at them more as historical documents, which is funny because, of course, I had talked to a lot of Aricra people and Pawnee people, and they always told me, like, well, you know, do you believe these stories? And I remember once this wonderful gentleman, this elder, Rodney Howling Wolf, who asked me, like, well, do you believe it? And I said, no. This was when I was still very much, and I saw the look in his disappointment. And now I wish I could go back to him. He passed away a couple of years ago, and say, like, you were right. There is history in this. This is not just myth as we use a myth as lie. Right. Although technically the term myth means story in Greek, but we use it as a lie, as a falsehood, as fiction. And I realized, no, there's not what we've lost. What we need to do as ethnohistorians, linguist scholars in general, is to learn that language, you know, and apply it. And so I started doing that. And it's been a wonderful journey. The book has a troubled history in the sense that it went through all kinds of versions. But looking back at it, so it took me more than, 10 years to write. But with every version, I added more of that oral tradition into it, analyzing it, explaining it, and at least, you know, when I say explain it, they're all hypothetical explanations because we can't really prove any of it, but to make sense out of them. And with every revision, I found more of these oral traditions, and I was like, yeah, this is what that means. This refers to this event. For example, now that I raised the example, when this smallpox epidemic hit, because I'm convinced it was smallpox, the Aricras left and they were saved when Mother Corn turned herself into a cedar tree, and out of the sky came Grandfather Rock, you know, and people found refuge on the cedar tree and on this rock. And that's how they survived this terrible epidemic. And then I realized, wait a minute, there is a place about 200 miles, 250 miles away from, or less than that actually, from where the Aricras lived at the time, where you find rocks and where you find cedar trees, and that is the Black Hills. And so, you know, in that sense, I started making sense out of these stories. This is something that really happened. Anthropologists tended to look at them as like, mine these oral traditions for, and this is not a criticism, right? Because historians do it too, but mine them for, like, what does it say about the culture? And I started looking as, well, what do these stories say about the history? Because I think they have something to say. In fact, my second book, goes into great detail about that. And with the Orikra book, it's like, you know, I could apply all kinds of oral traditions to things that we know happen. And there's, and this is the other part of it, there's a lot of these oral traditions that we just accept as stories, but we should accept them as histories, but simply because they're not documented in you know, European accounts and documents, you know, we don't take them seriously. But in fact, they have a lot to tell us about, you know, all the things that happened. Unfortunately, it's really difficult to pinpoint a specific location or pinpoint a specific time to that.
But
so that's the challenge. But
right, it's sort of so reflective of European outlook on the world. I mean, this is what we have, where we Europeans come from, is the idea that writing is primary and takes primacy over oral transmission, and that if it's not written down, it didn't happen. And we know now not to even to doubt that, because what's written down reflects the writer, and the story told by the, let's say if it's a history of a war, as we all know, the victor tells the story. So history as written is not literally accurate either, but we think of it as accurate. We're always trying to prove that what we, you know, that it's written down and must be true, or believe that it's written down and must be true, and therefore
you can take that even further now, David. We kind of distrust the written word because you know, but we believe what we see. And now we live in an age where we can't even trust and believe what we see anymore, right?
So, that's right.
And in that sense, maybe it helps people, you know, opens people's eyes to these stories. And it's like, hey, wait a minute, let's take another look at these, you know? So in the book I talk about, like, you know, there's in Plato's Phaedrus, he refers to the invention of writing. And in fact, you know, The lesson is like, well, it's not a blessing. It's actually a recipe for forgetting. And that's true. The way I look, and most people in you know, most of us Westerners look at it, I need to write things down in order to remember. We've lost that ability to really, really remember things, right? We use these tricks. And so here's a very different culture, an oral culture and an oral literary tradition, where they did, by the way, that also existed in Europe, right? The old, you know, the Homer's epic, you know,
or the Norwegian, isn't it the Eddas?
The Eddas, yeah, the sagas, yeah. They were all, yeah, like, you know, they were memorized. And now we just grab the book off the show. Well, actually, we open up our cell phone and we open it up there. But that was one of that's one of the most rewarding things, you know, that I have. Because as you write these books, and I worked with the Orikra people, they in fact funded the institute that I worked at Indiana University. And so it was so made me feel good that I was able to give something back and teach them something, or teach, that's maybe a strong word, but tell them something about these stories that, you know, go in there and say like, look, I was wrong. These stories do have great meaning, and here's what I think they mean. Because I want to make that point, you know, it's still in the end, it's hypothetical, it's speculative work. But I think my explanations in the book, especially in the early part of the book, which rely heavily on these oral traditions, you know, are I believe very plausible. So, and I have lots of examples of oral traditions and how we look at them again, even with speaking animals and things of that nature, where we're like, hey, wait a minute, okay, this actually does make sense if you interpret it if you don't take it literally. But if you take it in a different way, for example, the whirlwind, right? They had never experienced epidemics such as smallpox. They didn't know what it was. To them, it was a curse. You know, it was a divine kind of punishment for their failure to offer smoke. You know, the failure to conduct a ceremony properly. And this is what retaliation. So, but they had never seen smallpox. So, what kind of name do you give it? Well, there was a terrible storm. It was a whirlwind. That was the metaphor that they came up with. So it really is a lot about studies of metaphors.
Yeah, and actually that metaphor, if you think about it, and I know this is going to sound a little judgmental, but there was conflict in Native culture about adopting and contact with the Westerners, the white people coming, who brought things that we were, you know, there was trade that went on. And, you know, pre-contact, no metal, no, you know, no manufacturing, even no horses before the Spanish arrived. So it was not unexpected that people would want to trade for those Western goods, but there were always traditionalists and elders who were saying at the time, this is a mistake. We should not engage with these white people who are going to corrupt our culture. And if you look at, I mean, it's a terrible thing to realize that, you know, that if they had stayed away from the white people, they wouldn't have gotten diseases. You know, if they had just said, no, we don't want to have contact with all these weird people who are coming to, you know, explore our country, you know, that, so in a certain way, those, you know, myths are also expressive of psychological realities, so that they are true in a certain way. You know, it's not just in a kind of figurative way. They are true because our psyches are true. That is a true part of ourselves. Right. So they, you know, the storytelling expresses human culture and human belief. And so the tension between wanting contact and wanting to stay away from the foreigners is actually, I think, is expressed in the storytelling.
Right. Well, it's a dilemma for them, right? It's like, well, what do we do with them? And absolutely, there were some people who were like, this is scary and this could corrupt us. Others were like, well, no, we need them and we want what they have. So it's always this the struggle within a group. Like, well, you know, I taught in Qatar, at Texas A&M University in Qatar, as you know, they're in a process too, where they're like looking westward, and they're also looking towards their own past. It's like, well, we want the stuff that the West has, except for, you know, too much of that liberal, you know, too much of that stuff. So they're caught in this dilemma too. And so one of the reasons, in fact, that Texas A&M and Carnegie Mellon and Weill Cornell and Georgetown are invited to Qatar was like, yeah, we want that knowledge and we want that expertise and we want that a little bit of that culture. But at the same time, you know, we want to keep our kids here in the country and get these benefits and at the same time still be grounded and rooted in their own culture and their own traditions, and which makes perfect sense. You know, Native Americans really didn't really have that chance. It was kind of, you know, pressed on them, if you will. There is, by the way, and I you've read the book, so you're familiar with this story. There's a wonderful oral tradition in which the Irikars one day encounter this strange, mysterious man in the distance who's dressed in white and who has hair hanging from his mouth, which I remember reading that the first time. I was like, what is that? And just skipping it because I couldn't make sense out of it. And then later on, I learned of other stories from Iroquois people who said, like, well, this was their first encounter with Jesus. Jesus came and the Iroquois were scared of him and said, like, no, we don't want to deal with him. And then Jesus appeared in a dream to one of the Iroquois and said, like, you know, you've offended me. I came here to bring you all kinds of wonderful things. And now I'm going to go back and I'm going to give it to the white people. And the wonderful things that he was going to give were all kinds of extraordinary goods, metal tools, you name it. Okay. Knives, axes. I don't want to say guns yet, but, you know, all kinds of fantastic objects. And when I read that and, you know, of course, the first impulse of historians, me included, was just like, oh, okay, well, that was that story about Jesus is like a modern introduction in a otherwise old oral tradition. Until I started thinking about it, and was like, wait, this is kind of a funny Jesus. Yes, he looks like, you know, Jesus with his hair hanging from his mouth, like a beard, in other words, and in his white robe and all of that, you know. But he's not talking about peace. He's not talking about brotherhood, turning the other cheek, none of that stuff, right? You know, blessed are the meek, the poor. No, it's about like, hey, I got stuff. I got goods. And this is one of the ways in which I work then. It's like, well, I can treat it as a story that was added later on after missionaries came to live among the Arikaras. But if I believe that these stories are true, maybe it is an old story. And then I thought, like, well, maybe it wasn't Jesus that they met, but it was probably a French, you know, coureur de bois, you know, a runner of the woods, you know, an illegal smuggling kind of, you know, smuggling trader who was trying to sell stuff, and they were afraid of him. And later that morphed into Jesus. Okay.
Or it could have been cabeza de vaca. You know, I mean, I don't mean that literally, but it could have been a Spanish.
Yeah, absolutely.
Priest who had been lost, you know, on his way from, Albuquerque or Santa Fe, you know,
then this becomes a story of their first encounter with a white person. And so wait a minute, this then fits the history of what's happening. It's captured in these stories. And yeah, I think it's a traitor, but it could be something else, right? And the interesting thing is, because I've had other historians who go like, well, you know, we have stories like this all the time. It's like, great, you know, because then we have an actual encounter, you know, this is not the only one. And the funny thing is, why would they be afraid of a guy in white and looking different with a beard? Why would they be afraid of that? Well, there's another story, which is historically documented, of Lewis and Clark going upriver in 1804 and stopping among the Mandans, and they stay for a few days among the Arikaras as well. And William Clark had his African-American slave with him, York, well known in the literature. And when the Arikaras first saw him, they thought, you know, because he was black and colors have deep meaning and significance for the Arikaras Indian, Plains Indians, and probably Native Americans in general. You know, white is actually the color of mourning, the color of loss. You know, you just lost the battle. You cover yourself in white ashes. Whereas if you were victorious, you would paint yourself with soot, you know, to make yourself black. Black was the color of strength, victory. And so when York arrives there, the Arikaras had never seen an African-American before and thought he was the leader. And so, and they had attributed all kinds of magical powers to him. In fact, to the point where, you know, poor Arikaras or poor Native Americans would offer their wives to have sex with him in order to gain some of that power. You know, when we talk about Native Americans, especially Plains Indians, you know, what sets them, you know, what creates a hierarchy in society is not wealth, it's spiritual power. So you would try everything you can to get this spiritual power, either by going on a vision quest, by going to, you know, on in battle, and hopefully, you know, making a sacrifice that is worthy of some kind of spiritual reward, or it could be through a transfer through sex. And we see that with York. So in other words, this whole story about like them being afraid or being cautious around someone who is new and is different, you know, the story of York, I think, corroborates that. So, you know, it opens up all kinds of new ways of looking at these stories and these events.
So before, I don't want to lose track of the fact that your book also does not just cover the period of early pre and early contact. And so we should just mention that you bring you really is a history of the Arikaras through the present day. And I don't want to gloss over that. I think it's really important. I mean, we could talk for a long time about all of this because it's representative of so much of American history. More and more attention has been paid in the last few years to the abuses of the conquest system, both in the U.S. and in Canada, trying to destroy Native culture as a way of westernizing them and civilizing them. I put quotes around civilizing. But I also am reading a book about India right now. The British did the same thing there, which is to disrespect a culture that had been there for thousands of years and try to denude it of its power and meaning by enforcing change, you know, getting rid of cultural and religious practices that offended Western sensibilities. So you cover that whole period post, I'll call it conquest, into the 20th century. And I think one of the things that I think I didn't know about that I learned from your book was the Garrison Dam story. It's somewhere in the back of my mind. I'm sure I've run across it, but it's such an important, it's a real thing, but it's also so symbolic on multiple levels, because it's another flood. That the Arikaras came from a flood, and now they are almost destroyed by another flood. So maybe we should just cover this briefly, because it kind of brings us into the present era of the Arikara that you've spent a lot of time with.
Absolutely. Yeah. So let me just backtrack here a little bit on the first flood, as you mentioned. According to the oral tradition, it's the stories is that Neshanu Nachitaku, as he's called, the great chief above, created the universe, created the earth, and created the first people. And the first people were this race of giants who thought they were so powerful that they didn't need God. And so they were guilty of the sin of pride, as Christians would call it, right? It's a pride. You don't need God. You're powerful enough. And so he destroyed the first group of that by turning them into rocks, and they're now mountain ranges and things like that. And then he created the smaller race, still giants, who likewise believed that they were more powerful. And so he destroyed them through a flood, which the parallels with the biblical flood are immediately become obvious to people. And so they think like, okay, well, see, this is borrowed from Christian tradition, which I don't think so. But as he destroyed this race of giants for being disrespectful, he created this new group of people and as the water had receded, tried to put them in, on the earth, but through a bolt of lightning, and they end up inside the earth where they, germinate and eventually come up when mother corn helps them to emerge from the ground. So yeah, the flood is the beginning, and then you can read it at all kinds of levels, metaphorical, religious, etc. And cultural, of course, like I said, they grew corn. And so this connection between people, life coming from earth to them made perfect sense. By the way, we also believe in that kind of idea, right? We come from this land and water. Anyway, I'm getting sidetracked here. And yes, you're right. By the way, when we come to the 1940s and 50s, there's a flood in 1944, when the Missouri River, floods and destroys, cities and lots of property in Omaha and places like that. And so the Corps of Engineers comes up with a plan to tame the river and by building a series of dams. And one of the places they pick, so there's lots in South Dakota. One of the places they pick is just south of what will become the Arikara Mandan Hidatsa reservation. In a small town called Garrison, that's where they want to build that dam, and the result of that dam is, of course, that the most fertile lands of the Arikaras was flooded. Now, like I said, they were corn growers; they lived in river valleys. These periodic floods were a benefit to them because they fertilized the soil, etc. So they were really good creating a life for themselves out of that cycle. But then the Corps of Engineers comes around and then it floods that entire valley. They lose almost a third of their land and are forced to live on top. And as you mentioned, that nearly destroyed, and it did in fact destroy a lot of the culture, and it certainly destroyed trust in the government and created all kinds of economic problems, dependency on the government as well, because now their old way of life, they couldn't sustain that anymore. So they had to go to the government to get help. And this is one of the tragedies that's not just with the Arikaras, but Native America throughout, North America, where this would be repeated over and over. And we see it again, unfortunately, today. You may remember the Dakota Access Pipeline protests and the Keystone XL protests, that threaten now these communities with pollution and things of that nature. With the Arikaras also, we see hydraulic fracturing or fracking, which is a great a boom taking place in North Dakota. Actually, when I first did research in North Dakota on the reservation, I did field work, which is also not very common for historians. It's more of like what anthropologists do. And it was fairly empty. You could drive for a long time without ever seeing anyone. Then I came back a couple of years later, and it was just one truck after another, and it was just busy and all of that. And that's one of those other things that the Iroquois are very, Edmondans and the Dotsis too, were very sensitive about, like, well, what's this going to be next? Yes, they get royalties from oil revenues, but still, you know, the long-term effect, once that boom ends, where is it going to take them then? So it's kind of this mixed blessing is maybe too strong a word. I mean, they have had some advantages for it. Updating schools, you know, building cultural centers, renewing their museum. There's a wonderful initiative, which actually I feel I should mention here, because I didn't really talk about that in the book, because I stopped at the 1950s, because I think the present generation of Iroquois are much better at telling the history today than I could ever do that. And so I ended it more or less in the 1950s, but with the tribal chairman, Mark Fox. With the money from this hydraulic fracturing, he's now building greenhouses. And so we're going back to, and this is wonderful. I think this is an amazing kind of story. Like, we're going back to, let's grow corn, let's grow squashes, pumpkins, let's add bell peppers, let's add all these kind of things, because that fits with our traditional way of life. And so, so in that sense, there is a belief among many Iroquois that there will come a full circle when Mother Corn is going to come back and revitalize their culture, the way the things they had lost after the Garrison Dam was constructed. Because a lot of the culture was lost because people were moved away, suddenly were spread out. They send the kids to white schools and things like that. And they didn't come together again to perform these old ceremonies anymore. And as a result, they died. They passed away.
So in the current time frame, is there a kind of revitalization, revival of Arikara culture and language happening?
It's always been there a little bit, right? There's always these people who try to preserve as much as they can, and that's always been there. And so, but it's more this attrition, I suppose, right? This gradual declension of these practices, right? As one person dies. And then a good example of that is the language. You know, when we talked about 50, 60 years ago, when you talked about speakers, we're talking about people who actually, you know, who were fluent, you know, who were fluent speakers of the language. Then as that generation started passing away and you had the next generation, they were no longer fluent speakers, but they could understand it. Okay, they could understand, but they had to respond in English. And then they became the quote unquote speakers of the language. And then you move fast forward again, another generation or a generation and a half, and then there's these people who can't even understand. Well, can't even. They cannot understand it, but they've learned a song. They've learned a few prayers, a few sentences. Now they have become the quote unquote speakers. Okay, there is when I worked at Indiana University, Douglas Parks, the linguist. He in the 1960s started working doing field work among the Arikaras and Pawnees. Started among the Pawnees first, and then met someone, an Iroquois person, and did some comparative work. He collected all kinds of information. He did interviews. He recorded, and eventually, in the 1990s, started, you know, digitizing that with the new technology that came available, and started creating curricular material, like school materials, lesson materials, and that was a that was a start. And now with AI, I think, you know, there is the potential. Restoring a language that is dead, and Iroquois are not going to like it when I say that the language is dead, because they will, like I said, they will say, like, no, we still have speakers. But in practical purposes, you know, the language is almost gone. But with AI, it's almost impossible to get these languages back. But with AI, it is perhaps possible to get all the corpus of texts that we have, of recordings that still exist, to digitize that, analyze it, and then, yes, to bring the language back to life in that sense. And maybe some people, there are some very talented linguists working on the Iroquois language Most of them are not native, but so there's that. So the language is being revitalized, or at least people are making that effort, and the culture as well. And I hope my book, you know, contributed a little bit to that historical revitalization, you know, this awareness of like, yeah, you know, these oral traditions are, you know, are useful documents, are historical documents, and as well as religious documents as well. So, in that sense, I hope that this book contributes to that whole process. You know, people are actively trying to, you know, working hard to revitalize as much as they can, to preserve and to renew it. There is a problem with that. If you have another minute, David, you can tell I get all excited about this. As I mentioned before, the Arikaras and the Pawnees, they were the original Plains Indians, okay, among the original Plains Indians. They were not the only ones. And then they were kind of like dispossessed by the Lakotas, to a lesser extent, the Cheyenne, the Blackfeet, the Comanches, et cetera. They crowded out these nomadic natives, you know, crowded out the sedentary ones. And the irony of the story is that a lot of the Arikaras, younger generations, were actually now looking towards Lakota practices, such as the sun dance, for example, you know, to maintain some kind of sense of like tradition, like, you know, connection to native expressions, religious expressions, rather than Christian ones. Okay. So that's one of those ironies, but there are, you know, there are some attempts by native people, Arikaras, to, for example, bring back the mother corn ceremony, and, or at least, you know, parts of that. And I think that's exciting, but I don't really cover that in my book. Like I said, that's more of a something that the present generation should be talking about, and they're working on it.
Well, this has been really fun for me. I hope people will take a look at this book, because it is, I think it's a great story. You've done a really good job. The book is called Between the Floods, A History of the Arikaras. I've been talking to Mark Vandeloot. I really enjoyed doing this, Mark.
It was my pleasure. I wish we had more time, but I understand, you know. Plus, my daughter is getting ready to for the night, because it's already late here in the Netherlands.
Right, where you're in a different time zone than me. I have the day ahead of me, and you can get to go to sleep at some point.
That's right.
Thank you again. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Mark Vandeloot about Between the Floods, A History of the Arikaras.